Last night we said that as communicators we have a twofold task. One is to get the message together, and we've spent a good deal of time on that. The other is to get it across. You may be A, you must get it from A to B. One writer on this subject says, if you ask a boy to deliver a parcel, it's not delivered if he throws it over the back fence or under a bridge somewhere. It's only delivered if it arrives at its destination. A message is not delivered because it leaves the preacher's mouth. It's only delivered if it arrives in the heart of the hearer. Same is true of teaching. I haven't taught you anything unless you've learnt something. Isn't that so? Now, many people feel that they've done their duty because the message has left them. But we've really only done our duty if it arrived. And that's what delivery is all about. Now, there are two kinds of communication involved in delivery. One is verbal communication and the other non-verbal. Both are very important. One of the best books on verbal communication that I know is this little book by Sue Nichols called Words on Target. Even the title's good, don't you think? Words on Target. Now, Nichols really is saying there are three essential ingredients for good verbal communication. One is economy. The other is energy. And the third is subtlety. Is that right? Subtlety. Is there an E in subtlety? Right. Now, what does she mean by economy? Well, it means that you prefer the short word to the long word, the short sentence to the long sentence. You get rid of all unnecessary words. One of the books that's for sale over there is this book by Alfred P. Gibbs. He was a Brethren writer, so if you only read Brethren books, then there's one on this particular subject. Now, he gives a couple of examples of what not to do in this area of economy. A boy once inquired of his father, "What makes leaves fall off the trees?" The father replied, "It is a phenomenon of nature that only occurs in deciduous trees to protect them from cold temperatures. The leaf is sealed at the node, shutting off the food supply, so it withers and dies. Does this answer your question?" The boy replied, "I guess so, except what makes the leaves fall off the trees?" A copywriter was once asked to describe Ivory soap for advertising purposes. He wrote, "The alkaline elements and vegetable fat in this product are blended in such a way as to secure the highest quality of saponification alone, with a specific gravity that keeps it on top of the water, relieving the bather of the trouble and annoyance of fishing around for it in the bottom of the bathtub during his ablution." When this reached the advertising manager, he crossed it out and substituted for it two words. They were, "It floats." Now, that's what is meant by economy. And you have to work at it. Now, if you have a short space of time, then you can't afford to go too deep, and you can't afford to handle too large a slice of your subject. Now, let me give you a sample of this book. If you can get hold of this book, then I recommend it. Words on Target. Compare these two descriptions. Let us suppose we have lived for 3 months at an inter-church work camp, and the inevitable time has come for a brief report. Here's one way that you might give it. We lived in close quarters with young people from other lands. We had to learn to understand their points of view. We had to adjust to their forms of courtesy and accept them even when they seemed strangest. We had to, on and on. It doesn't really grab you. Now here's an alternative. I met Ingrid in our bunk room and took an instant dislike to her. She wore her hems 1 inch above the fashion line and criticised me for chewing gum. Or, Han stomped into the dining hall with a Leica around his neck and a chip on his shoulder. Now, can you see how fresh the second alternative is to that first generalised statement? Now, economy means that you are crisp, you are brief, you are simple, where it's not necessary to be complex. One man by the name of Robert Gunning has drawn up what he calls a fog index. And you may be interested to just note how to calculate the fog index of your writing, and perhaps if you ever write out a sermon, you could check it out. This is what you do. Firstly, you take a sample of 100 words, approximately. And you count the number of sentences in that sample of 100 words and divide it into the 100 so that you come up with the words per sentence in a sample of about 100 words. Everybody clear on that one? The second thing that you do is count the difficult words. Now, a difficult word is described as having 3 or more syllables. 3 or more syllables. Now, words that are not to be included are words which are a combination of 2 simple words. A word like butterfly would not be counted. Nor would a word with ing on the end or ed. So decided would not be counted as a difficult word because it's got an ED on the end of it. Thirdly, you multiply 1 and 2 together. Your answer there, it might have been 8 words per sentence. This might have been 17 difficult words in the 100 words, right? You multiply 1 and 2. Sorry, you add 1 and 2 together, beg your pardon. You add 1 and 2 together, and then you multiply that by 0.4. Now, that'll give you a number, which is the fog index. Now, if, for example, the fog index was 12, that would be pretty foggy, because it's roughly equivalent to the reading level of a grade 12 student. The Reader's Digest comes out at about 9. Now, that means the Reader's Digest is pitched at about a grade 9 student. Now, good communication should have 10 or less for its fog index. Now, I don't know whether you want to practice this in a little example. We could quite easily do it. We could take a page from 2 different Bibles, and I'm sure you'd get different fog indexes. I have a feeling that something like the New English Bible or the New American Standard Bible would probably be more foggy than, say, the New International Version. And you might be surprised that the Authorised Version would probably shape up quite well, surprisingly, because the number of big words in the Authorised Version is really quite small. In fact, I think I have some statistics here on the Authorised Version which might be interesting. Listen to this. The average length of the words in the Authorised Version is 5 letters. There are 810,000 odd words, but there are only 6,000 different words. And the average length is only 5 letters. So you won't get too many 3-syllabled words in the Authorised Version. Now, of course, the these and the thous put some people off on the old-fashioned words, but in terms of crispness, the Authorised Version is really very good writing. And that's one reason why people who were brought up on the Authorised Version, people like John Bunyan, have such a way with words. That's not to say that we should retain it forever and a day, but it's certainly been a great monument in English literature. All right, now the second word is energy. Now, what is meant by energy? I hope everybody's clear on economy. Is everybody clear on economy? Energy. Energy means the driving force of your vocabulary, of your words. Now, the most powerful word in the sentence is the verb, the action word. Now, not all verbs are of equal power. For example, the verb to be is not a powerful verb. It just kind of sits there. Tom is a baker. It's not as strong as Tom bakes bread for Tip Top, is it? Do you feel the difference? Tom is a baker. There's Tom. He is a baker. He just stands there. But Tom bakes bread. There's more action there. Do you follow? So the verb to be is not a good communicator. But verbs generally are far better than nouns. They're better than adjectives. Now, I could give you one or two examples. Take the Bible verse. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. That's fairly strong because you've got the verb, if anyone strikes you, turn. There's two verbs there. Now, the alternative would be, if anyone is unruly to you, do not be unruly to them. That is not as strong, because you've got those weak verbs to be there with the adjectives. Are you following me? Sorry if your grammar's a little bit backward, but it doesn't hurt to understand a bit about English grammar. I don't know whether you know the difference between active voice and passive voice, but I'll illustrate. The hunter shot the lion is active voice, because the doer of the shooting is the subject of the sentence. The passive voice would be, the lion was shot by the hunter. Now, which is the more powerful in communicating, the active or the passive? The active. It sort of moves forward. The hunter shot the lion, but the lion was shot. He just stood there and received the bullet, and that's all he did. It's not as powerful, is it? You see the difference? Another thing that helps you with energy is being specific. Don't be vague. On our refrigerator, it may be a dig at me, but on our refrigerator we have a little cartoon from that Viking. What's his name? Hagar the Horrible. He's visiting the doctor, and the doctor is asking him some questions. He says things like, does it hurt? And Hagar says, oh, here and there. Then the doctor says, do you feel nauseous? Oh, now and then. And finally, Hagar asks the doctor, is it serious? And the doctor says, yes and no. Now, you see how vague it is. Now, let's take some examples. Instead of saying, there were many people present. Say there were 2,000 people present. Instead of saying there were few people present, say there were 5 people present. Instead of saying a long time ago, say in AD 70. Instead of saying in the near future, say 2 weeks from today. Instead of saying from one city to another, say from Corinth to Jerusalem. Instead of saying a certain address, say the house of Judas on the street called Straight. You're making it concrete. People can grasp concrete language. They can visualise it. And that's why, when I read the two accounts of the interchurch camp, the vague one, we met people from different lands, does not communicate as well as Ingrid bustled into the bunkhouse chewing gum. You follow? Now this calls for imagination. And really we ought to spend a lot of time on this issue of imagination. Imagination is a great ally of the preacher. One reason Spurgeon was a great preacher was that he had a very good imagination. Now imagination doesn't mean that you have to fiddle with the facts. But it allows you to be creative. You can make up dialogues. You can have the Apostle Paul there. Paul, why did you risk your life there? And Paul says, well, it was because. And Peter Branham does this. Have you ever noticed Peter Branham? He sometimes has a little conversation with somebody imaginary there. That's using the imagination. Now, there's a nice example here in Brown's book of vagueness. There was a divinity student who desired above all things to be guarded in his utterance. He said to his people one Sunday, with his head on one side and the vox humana stop and his voice pulled out full length, "My beloved hearers, if I may call you so, you are under some measure of moral obligation to repent, so to speak. And in case you do not, I would venture to suggest that there is a remote possibility that you may be damned, as it were, to a certain extent." Energy. The third matter is subtlety. Subtlety. Now, subtlety is illustrated in your not pressing the moral of the story. We all know how disappointing it is when we've come to the punchline of a joke and nobody's laughed and we've had to explain it. It's embarrassing, isn't it? And even when you explain it, of course, there's not much of a laugh. You've killed it. The same is true of an illustration. The more explaining you've got to do for your illustration, the less effective it is. I think you got the point of that illustration about speaking to Mary, those three people who disobeyed the Spirit's voice, didn't you? Didn't really need anything to be said afterwards. It was telling enough. The Lord Jesus was very clever here. On one occasion he told the parable, and we finish with these words. They sought to take him, for they perceived that he had spoken this parable against them. They were not wrong. But he didn't have to make that point. He didn't have to say, now, the wicked husbandmen in this parable represent you. He didn't need to say that. They got the message through the back door. And whenever the message is preached to the individual by the individual instead of by you, the preacher, it always comes home with more forcefulness. Because within every one of us, there is an instinctive reaction to defend ourselves. But when our own conscience speaks to us, it seems to prick more than when somebody else tries to get at it. You know what I'm saying? So the more subtle you can be, the better. Nichols puts it like this: mean more than you say. Mean more than you say. Now, back to your notes. Point four. Strive for freshness. I said a little bit about that earlier. It's worth repeating. We have a lot of stock phrases in our evangelical vocabulary. When they were first invented, they were probably beautiful. But 100 years later and 5 million repetitions later, they are dead. And you must resist the temptation to use those words which just flow out of your mouth without any thought being required. Be unpredictable. Avoid worn out phrases. For example, take the word walk. Now, you can use the word walk for a fat lady running for the bus. She probably is going at a walking speed anyway. You can use it for a duck, if you like. But there are so many beautiful words in English which help us to visualise the style of walking. Think of these words. Saunter. Waddled.
What's another one? Let me think.
Lurched. What was the one you had? Pranced. Good. What about minced? Do you know what minced means? This is how you mince. They're very descriptive words. What about shuffle? Or strut? Or plod? Or dawdle? Or slouch? Aren't they better than walk, 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 walk? Far better. But you've got to work to get those words. Fifthly, make use of dialogue. Help your hearers see and feel what you say. Help them see and feel. Most of you know C.S. Lewis as a writer, I hope. He's an excellent communicator. It's a sheer joy to read some of his writing. He wrote a letter once to a child in America. And this is what he said. Don't use adjectives which merely tell us how you want us to feel about the thing you are describing. I mean, instead of telling us the thing was terrible, describe it so that we'll be terrified. Don't say it was delightful. Make us say delightful when we've read the description. That's good. Did you get the point? There's supposed to be an Oriental proverb which says, he is an eloquent man who turns his hearers' ears into eyes and makes them see what he speaks of. Then this matter of relevance, human interest, and concrete in the second line of point five. People will always listen if they think there's something in it for them. Spurgeon says that he's never known of anybody to go to sleep while a will was being read. He's never known of a prisoner who's gone to sleep while the judge was summing up the case. Because he had an interest in the verdict. To come back to the Reader's Digest for a moment, why is it read by so many people? Because it deals with matters of human interest. One of the sections, as you know, is called Life's Like That. And often you can see yourself in the little anecdotes that are told. Homely little things that happen around the house. You'll notice also that in communication that is easy to read, there's often a lot of inverted commas. It's pretty dull to pick up a book, a novel, and have page after page of solid blocks of paragraph. It's a relief when you get people talking, isn't it? And if you can do that in your message too, it will help people to listen. Aim to preach without reading. Now, of course, that's a problem. And perhaps at this point we should just say a word or two about your notes. Should you write them all out, word for word or not? Well, there is value in it. Because when you write, you have to hunt for that better word, and your expression will certainly improve. But my advice is don't take that full manuscript with you into the pulpit. Take a condensed version of it. My habit is to take cards of that size. And as a rule, I can fit my message onto two sides of a card like that. Now, of course, if you wrote it out in full, it would take pages. But take an illustration. You may merely need to put David Livingstone or Speak to Mary or Mustardy Tea or whatever in your notes and the whole thing will come back to you. Do you follow? If you've read it over in your full manuscript. The value of not taking a full manuscript up and reading it is that you are able to make eye contact with your congregation and they feel that you're with them. It's never the same when somebody's reading. And another thing is this, that when you read, your gestures, which we'll talk about in a moment because they belong to the non-verbal communication, your gestures tend to be unnatural. You know, sort of reading like this. Now, that's meaningless. Broder says that reading is harder on the voice. I think that's true. You try reading for say, 3/4 of an hour, you'll probably find your throat gets tighter than if you're just talking to somebody for 3/4 of an hour. Anybody ever notice that? And furthermore, if you keep doing it, keep relying upon your notes, you may delay the day when you can be rid of them. In other words, the day when you can speak extemporaneously may be pushed further into the future. The reader is not open to fresh thoughts like the non-reader. You know, some of the best thoughts come in the middle of your sermon. And if you're wise, you'll jot them down for the next time round. Furthermore, the person who reads his message, he really can't cope with distractions. And worse still is the person who memorises his message. I've seen it happen where a fellow is going along like Billy Graham and has a lapse of memory and that's the end. You've had it. And of course, this comes back to the issue of good structure. If you've got good structure, then you've got the bones and it's not so easy to flesh it out on the way through. Now, let's go to non-verbal communication. I wonder if we realise how important non-verbal communication is. Here are some statistics that may be of interest to you. Only 7% of the impact of a speaker's message comes through his words. I don't know how they work that out, but even if it's 50% or 100% wrong, it's still not very much. Did you hear that? 7% of the impact of the speaker's message comes through his words, 38% from his voice, and 55% from facial expressions. Now that seems exaggerated. Even if you take 20% off some of those, it's still quite remarkable. Robinson notes that whilst thought, arrangement, language, voice and gesture are in that order as far as significance is concerned, the order is reversed as far as impression is concerned. After all, surely when you're preparing a message, the content, the ideas, are more important than whether you thump on the pulpit 3 times or only 2 times. But in terms of the impression that you make, the whole list is put round the other way. So that in terms of impression, gesture is first and thought is last. According to research, when verbal and non-verbal communication contradict each other, people believe the latter, that is the non-verbal, before the former. Remember the bald man trying to sell a hair restorer? Will they believe what he says or what they see? Listen to this. The preacher who really believes the half-truth will have more power than the preacher who half-believes the whole truth. Now that's serious because it means that a sincere communist may be more effective than an insincere Christian. We've all heard of George Whitefield. Well, there was an unbeliever by the name of David Hume who was found hurrying along a London street one day when a friend asked where he was going, and he said, to hear George Whitefield. But surely you don't believe what Whitefield preaches, do you? He replied, no, I don't. But he does. In other words, the very enthusiasm of Whitefield made the man want to go and hear him, even though he didn't believe what he was going to say. Consider how much is conveyed by a shrug of the shoulders or a lifting of the eyebrows. Let's look at our Bibles for a moment. Proverbs 6, 12 and 13. A worthless person, a wicked man, walks with a perverse mouth. He winks with his eyes, he shuffles with his feet, he points with his fingers. That's justice. You know the situation. Maybe you've gone on a world tour and you've arrived in Cairo and you've got 6 hours to fill in before the boat sets sail for London. And you're walking down this Oriental bazaar. You don't know any of the language, but you're going to try a hand at bartering. And you've got a camera around your neck and a pith helmet on the top and a safari suit on. And you walk up to the bazaar and there are a couple of Arabs there, stern faces. And they see you coming from about 3 miles off. And they just go, "You're going to be taken for a ride." That wink meant such a lot. And that's the sort of thing I think Proverbs is talking about. You know, maybe just a shuffling of the feet. It's a message, a silent message. And when we preach, people are not only hearing, they're looking. And far more is being conveyed than we realise by that para-message, the message alongside the spoken one. Now, what are the forms of non-verbal communication? Well, one is appearance and dress. Now, you can overdo this. In certain circles, if you overdo the dress, that'll have a negative effect. If you underdo it in certain circles, that'll have a negative effect. If you go with a top hat and a bow tie to the young people's barbecue meeting, you know, you won't go over too well. Dress is important. Let me give you an illustration of that. In the magazine Psychology Today, there was the report of a 3-month study done on 7 salesmen to determine the influence of dress on sales. At a time when jeans and safari jackets are turning up in even the most sedate establishments, does wearing a business suit matter anymore? In some businesses, it evidently does. When salesmen in a Montgomery, Alabama men's store wore suits, the average value of their sales was 43% higher than when they wore shirt sleeves and a tie, and 60% higher than when they wore an open collar shirt. That sounds fantastic, doesn't it? So any businessman here, if you want your sales to climb, put on a nice suit. Eye contact. This is very, very important. I find Bob Hawke a bit hard to take at this point. You know, sort of shifty eyes. Have you ever noticed that? Doesn't build confidence, does it? Whatever your political persuasion, I'm not making a political statement here. I'm simply making an observation. I just notice it. I don't like the person who comes up and shakes me by the hand like this. Do you? Or like this. Or like this. And it's the same when you preach. If you can't look a person in the eye, he's not sure whether you're really talking to him. And of course, if you've got your head buried in your notes and you just sort of do this every now and again, that's not very convincing either. So there's appearance and dress, there's eye contact. Thirdly, there are facial expressions and gestures. A gesture is a movement with a message. Now, we must avoid extremes. I mentioned this book by Spurgeon, Lectures to My Students. Do have a look at it. He's even got diagrams, a bit overdone, but illustrating gestures for the recital of a poem. But listen to what he has to say. When Nathan addressed David, I suppose that he delivered his parable very quietly, and that when the time came to say, "Thou art the man," he gave the king a deeply earnest look. But younger ministers imagine that the prophet strode into the middle of the room and, setting his right foot forward, pointed his finger like a pistol between the royal eyes and, giving a loud stamp of the foot, shouted, "Thou art the man!" Had it been so done, it is to be feared that the royal culprit would have had his thoughts turned from himself to the insane prophet and would have called for his guard to clear the hall. Spurgeon's got a point. I think I've done that dramatic Nathan stunt, but I've probably been wrong. You don't speak to kings like that if you value your head. And so you must be careful how you express your gestures. Try to read into the story and get the feel of it. Avoid extremes. The nervous speaker is in danger of random gestures. Meaningless ones. Spurgeon again. You may see them wringing their hands while they are dilating upon the joys of faith, or grasping the side of the pulpit convulsively when they are bidding the believer hold all earthly things with a loose hand. Even when no longer timorous, brethren do not always manage their gestures so as to make them run parallel with their words. Men may be seen denouncing with descending fist the very persons whom they are endeavouring to comfort. No brother among you would, I hope, be so stupid as to clasp his hands while saying the gospel is not meant to be confined to a few. It would be an equal blunder if you were to spread forth your arms and cry, brethren, concentrate your energies, gather them up as a commander gathers his troops to the royal standard in the day of battle. In other words, your gestures must suit the words. They must run parallel. They are useful for emphasis, but must never follow the emphatic word. So you don't say, the time to repent is now. If anything, slightly before. Or at the same time. They should be suggestive, not imitative. Now by that is meant that you shouldn't be an actor. For example, if you're saying that the Lord poured water into a bowl, then you don't have to actually imagine that you've got a jug in your hand and be pouring. You might just say, he poured water into a bowl. In other words, it's a suggestive movement rather than an imitative one where you're an actor out there on the stage with a jug in your hand. Or if you said that the murderer stabbed the man in the back, there's no need to go, he stabbed the man in the back. Just be imitative. He stabbed the man in the back. You see, you're suggesting, but you're not actually imitating the action. Otherwise, you become a clown. Point D. Adams, that's J. Adams, who's written prolifically on all sorts of subjects, but he does have this book called Pulpit Speech. He says that gestures can function to describe. So you can say, Goliath was so tall. They can emphasize. No. They can indicate over there. He says that all movements should say something, and he gives the following example. He says that stepping to the side of the pulpit may indicate a transition. You may have been reaching a climax at the end of point one, and you say, now there's another reason. Do you get the feel? There's another reason why we should spend more time in prayer. It's this. And then you move back behind the pulpit. So that very action of moving to the side of the pulpit suggests a transition from point one to point two. Stepping forward may indicate intimacy or concern. And stepping back may indicate aloofness or relaxation. Point E just mentions that you can use your arms, your hands, your fingers, your whole body to suggest a wide range of meanings: despair, exhilaration, determination, desperation. The level of the gestures is suggested. Low is the debased level. You wouldn't talk about heaven and put your hands down here. The high level, that's deity, noble ideas. And in the middle is just general conversation. He recommends that you should switch off the sound on your TV and just watch the actions and notice the gestures. That's non-verbal communication. Now, you shouldn't study. You shouldn't put little notes in the side of your manuscript saying, thump on the pulpit. It should be natural. It should just flow out. If you are a certain type of a Frenchman, for example, are very given to gestures, certain types of personalities, I remember I was once at a camp and there was a comment book, and one kid wrote the comment that he'd enjoyed the animated talks. Now, I don't know whether he meant by that I was a cartoon character or what, but obviously he thought that I roved around a fair bit, and I do. Now, that's me. Don't copy people. You've got to be yourself. If you're a quiet person, don't try to be somebody else. In Sydney, there was an evangelist called Norm Harris. He was with the Sydney City Mission. Did anybody ever know Norm Harris? The most hilarious preacher you ever met. There was also a principal of the Baptist College down there called Principal Morling, one of God's gentlemen, a real quiet man. He would preach like this, you know, dearly beloved, that type of thing, and his hands would be going like this. And Norm Harris's wife once said, "Why can't you be like Principal Morling?" And so Norm Harris thought he'd try to be like Principal Morling, and he got up and he tried to be very sedate. And afterwards his wife told him it was terrible. So he went back to being Norm Harris again. Now, we've got to do that. You've got to be yourself. But here's something that's encouraging. I read this just recently. This is not a plea for you to be proud, but believe in your own uniqueness. Did you hear me? Believe in your own uniqueness. For example, when you're reading a commentary, don't feel inferior to the writer of that commentary. Don't feel that because he said it this way, it must be this way, even though your inner conviction is that he's wrong. Because you happen to have a different style from Billy Graham or some other great, and you tend to feel coward and not worthy to even open your mouth on a Sunday morning, don't try to copy that other person. God has made you as you are, and you have a contribution to make as you are. And make it without trying to ape somebody else. Believe in your own uniqueness. Romans says that we ought not to think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think, but as it's been said, we ought not to think of ourselves more lowly than we ought to think. Now that doesn't mean that we're to be proud. It means we're to be realistic. If you can really play the piano and somebody says, "Oh, can you play?" "Oh no, I can't play the piano." That's false humility. It's really an inverted form of pride. What's more, it's not even true. We need to be realistic. We need to recognise the gifts that God has given to us. And perhaps, and I'm going to close off now, we may just have a little time for questions or discussion if you would like that. But can I just quote again that verse from 1 Peter? And leave this with you. 1 Peter chapter 4. Verse 10. As each one has received a gift, not the gift as the Authorized Version has, it's as each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. If anyone ministers, let him do it as with the ability which God supplies, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong the glory and the dominion for ever and ever. Amen. Now this is an encouraging passage. It means that everyone in this room has received a charisma from God. Isn't that wonderful? But it was given to you by the grace of God. In fact, the word charisma has the word grace in it. Charisma is a word for gift, but charis is a word for grace. And a charisma is something that's given to you by the grace of God. It's not something you earn. It's not something that you can pat yourself on the back for. There is no room for pride whatsoever. As 1 Corinthians 4 verse 7 says, "What hast thou that thou didst not receive? Now if thou didst receive it, why dost thou glory as if thou hadst not received it?" No room for pride. Any gift that we've got is given to us through the manifold grace of God. We have no room for pride. Now, what must we do with that gift? Well, Peter says here, if you've got a gift, you must minister the same. You must minister the gift that God has given to you, not some other gift. Romans 12 says the same thing. It says, if your gift is teaching, then you teach. If it is prophecy, then prophesy. If it is giving, then give. If it is showing mercy, then show mercy. If it's exhortation, then exhort. And I come back to what I said this afternoon. We have been too democratic in the assembly. We have not discovered who has the gift. We've just shared it all around. God says we must minister the same. Whatever gift is given. There are people who have a gift and they have no ministry. Because like Timothy, they are neglecting it. They need to stir it up. And there are people who think they have a ministry, but it is very limited because it does not represent the outworking of a gift. You can have a gift with no ministry. You can have a so-called ministry, but if it's not the outer working of a gift, it will be virtually ineffective. God is a strategist. He doesn't give this ear the ability to hear and then expect it to see. And then Peter says, we should minister this gift as good stewards. That's a good word, steward. It means somebody who is given responsibility for another person's property. And he must be a faithful man. Someone who can be trusted when the master's back is turned. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, a steward, it is required of stewards that a man be found faithful. And God expects that gift which he has given you in trust will be administered faithfully, because you're a steward of it. It's not yours. It's given to you to be used in trust. And then Paul divides these gifts into two classes. They seem to be the practical and the spoken gifts. He says, if you speak, then speak as the oracles of God. If you minister, do it with God's help. And the whole end is that God may be glorified. Now, we've been speaking mainly over this weekend about speaking, about preaching, about communication. And if God has given you a gift in that area, and there are a lot of gifts in the speaking area, you just think of them. A word of wisdom, that's a speaking gift. A word of knowledge, that's a speaking gift. The gift of evangelism is a speaking gift. The gift of teaching is a speaking gift. The gift of exhortation is a speaking gift. Probably speaking is included in the gift of showing mercy. And there are other speaking gifts. Many of the gifts are associated with communication. They're not all getting up in a pulpit and giving a series of Bible studies. And if your gift is speaking, whether it's a one-to-one thing or with a group, Peter says, do it as the oracles of God. Look upon yourself as a channel of divine communication and speak with authority. Thus saith the Lord. None of this may be, perhaps. No. God says it. Now, some people might think I come over too strongly. I don't apologise for it. Not one little bit. As far as I'm concerned, if I have a gift, it's in this area of communication. And I've got to speak as the oracles of God and so have you. We're not to pussyfoot with the message. But our aim is that God may be glorified in all things. And we pray that out of this seminar, glory may come to God through an improvement in our communication of his truth within the assembly and beyond. Now, are there any questions or comments people would like to make? We won't drag this out, so be quick. Yes? Yes. Yes. Very wise. I think some of us at times feel that there is something magical about biblical words. No. If you use the word propitiation and nobody understands what you're talking about, it'll do nothing. Nothing. It's not a magic formula. So you're absolutely correct. Any other questions? All right. Yes, at the back. Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. And that's why George Whitfield, when he was once asked if someone could have permission to print his sermons, he said, oh yes, but you can't print the thunder and the lightning. That's right. A tape recorder, even a videotape, I'm afraid to say, is no substitute for person to person. I think it's a bit like going to a symphony concert. Listening to a record is not the same as being there, is it? But there's another factor, and it's a mystical factor in a sense. Jesus said, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst. And perhaps that's got something to do with it. The presence of godly people, praying people in a meeting, I think, is conducive to the working of the Spirit of God, more than just switching on a piece of electronic media. I found myself, if I've watched one of these preachers on TV, I feel a certain distance. I feel that I'm very much a spectator of the whole thing, and I'm more likely to be critical, or to, even while he's talking, I'll say something to my wife. You know what I mean? There's not that same rapport as when a person is looking you in the eye in flesh and blood.